The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Clifford Kindy. He joins us on the telephone in Indiana. Welcome to the program today, sir.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be a part of Book Nook.
Well, we're honored to have you on the telephone on your beautiful landline. And you have a book out. It's called Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War, 30 Years with Christian Peacemaker Teams. That's quite a title.
It's a big mouthful, yes.
Before we get into this book, which is really about you, tell us about yourself. Where are you from? What have you been doing all these years?
Well, let's see. I'm a preacher's kid. I was born while Dad and Mom were in Brethren Volunteer Service working at a migrant camp in Florida. I was named after a friend of theirs, Clifford Nakagawa, who was in the U.S. concentration camps because his parents were from Japan. I grew up in Ohio and Michigan. We live presently for the last 37 years in North Manchester, Indiana, on a farm. Arlene and I, my wife and I, have an organic market garden. We grow and sell fruits and vegetables, but that's a seasonal income, and it frees us up to do other things. So for 30 years of my life, I've done work with Christian peacemaker teams in conflict zones around the world. And then we've also done a lot with disaster work, responding after tsunamis or earthquakes or hurricanes or tornadoes or floods, fires, those kinds of things, volunteering our time. Arlene's usually cooking, and I'm usually helping with leading a construction team. Mm. And we have two children, and we still do garden, and we enjoy life.
What is a Christian peacemaker team?
Christian peacemaker teams. I guess it started as a vision of Ron Sider at a Mennonite World Conference in France about 1983. He said, what if Christians took their peacemaking as seriously as warriors take their war making? You know, in terms of training, in terms of risk taking, in terms of investment of finances and money, terms of telling the stories. What would happen? And out of that vision developed Christian peacemaker teams. I was invited to be on the steering committee early on. That was my beginning CPT. I'd heard about it. I thought, wow, that's a cool thing. Mm. What's it going to look like? Well, that's what we developed, what it's going to look like. So we did visits to different places, and then started getting invitations. Would you send a team of Christian peacemakers? And so I've worked on four continents, I guess, as an organization. We've worked on five different continents, sometimes just accompanying folks, sometimes more dramatic intervention, sometimes providing encouragement for folks who are already doing great stuff, a variety of things. So it's been some of the most exciting parts of my life.
I'll say. My guest is Clifford Kindy. His book is Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War. What led you to write this and publish this book? What was your motivation?
Well, I guess it started when I go on a project. I always take a little spiral notebook and always carry it in my pocket. And so I'm always writing down details or information or questions or contacts or all kinds of things. And so I have like a shoebox, a big shoebox, packed full of these spiral notebooks. And I was hoping, well, maybe my daughter, maybe Erin, will write this as a book sometime. And it became clear that Erin wasn't going to write a book about me. She might write it about herself, but not about me. And I said, well, how can I pass on? I mean, it feels like a wealth of experiences and information that it's important for other people to know. How do I pass it on to the next generation? And here in the at the farm, we have interns all the time, and that's part of it. But I began to share with them and invite them sometimes to go on CPT delegations with me. Some of them have gone through CPT training and out on projects of their own. I said, well, I need to get it down so people can find it. So that was a big part of the reason to get it out there.
Cliff, as we read the book, we learn a lot about what you believe and what you think and your opinions. And I wonder if you could share with our listeners what you think about the United States and our place in the world and how we act as a nation and what's right or wrong about that.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a rural high school in Ohio. I was, you know, pretty traditional. I enjoyed studies. I enjoyed athletics. I lettered in football and track. And probably toward the end of my school year in high school, I said, wow, this was during Vietnam. And I said, what should I do? So I joined the Green Beret. I mean, I was athletic. I want something athletic. I want something that's going to push me. Well, I should join the Green Beret. The Green Beret, the Ballad of the Green Beret was out. But then I started hearing the stories from Vietnam, from friends who were there, from others. I was in college, had a deferment initially. Said, what's going on? And so it began to raise some questions in my mind. I said, no, I don't think that's consistent with how I was raised. I don't think that's consistent with who we're called to be as people from the United States. So how do you change things? Can things change? And you know, as we work with peace and war situations around the world, we often, Arlene and I often come back to Joyfield Farm and say, maybe the most important thing we do for peacemaking is here at Joyfield Farm. We model what we want our future to be. We try to live that out in terms of relationships with other people, with people who agree with us, people who disagree with us. And in one sense, that's what we need to do as a world. We need to find a way that we can live with each other, whether it's people we agree with or disagree with. And it's not like we have answers to all the problems facing us as a world. And it's not like some genius is going to sit over in a corner and find the answers. It's going to be all of us working together because we all bring different pieces of that puzzle. I'm working on a puzzle right now. We all bring different pieces of that puzzle together to find an answer or to work toward an answer. A lot of the questions we have in our society don't have answers, but we have to be willing to grapple with them and struggle together with our differences, with our different experiences, with our different ideas, with our different perspectives, because I think it's in doing that that we can find a future. So as part of the United States, I realize we've got lots of, our beautiful country. I've traveled the mountains and the deserts and the plains and the shorelines and the lakes and the rivers. It's a fantastic country. And I think in many ways, one of the best mixes of people, one of the strengths we have as a country is all the strains of people that come into it, whether it's Native Americans, African Americans, immigrants from Europe, from Asia, from Africa, and that's all of us. That's where we all are. And the fact that we've made it this long, I think, is a credit to what we're about. But, some of the groups I've mentioned, we've done horrendous things to First Nation people in this country. Our congregation sits on Potawatomi land. I live on Miami land on the south side of the Eel River. We've decimated. Maybe things are changing. I hope. But I want to be a part of that change. For African Americans brought here as slaves, is there any kind of restitution that makes that right? I don't know. But I'm willing to struggle and try to work at that. I think Black Lives Matter is pushing us to work at those issues in important ways. We have a military system. I think bases in 170 or 80 countries around the world. We spend more than the next 10 countries of the world put together on military defense. Well, if military defense worked, we wouldn't be doing that. If it worked, we wouldn't have to keep doing it over and over again. So why can't we use those monies on people things? Correcting some of the things that we need help with in our society, whether it's environment, whether it's justice, whether it's infrastructure. We have the money there. Why spend it on war? So those are things that I want to work at, and that's what we've spent our lives on. And so how do we make our country better? I've seen the horrible parts of the United States, and that's not a credit to us as a country. So let's change it. We can. That's what democracies are about.
In case you're just tuning in, it's the Book Nook. My guest today, Clifford Kindy, joining us on the phone in Indiana. His book is Resurrection, Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War. I'll continue my conversation with Cliff right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, making radio with the community and for the community, and making radio today with Clifford Kindy in the Book Nook. His book is Resurrection, Peacemaking, Plowsharing, the Tools of War. He joins us on the telephone in rural Indiana on his farm out there. And Cliff, this book, wow, you've been everywhere. You've had some amazing experiences, and you detail a lot of them in this book. What was your first experience? What was the first place you went with the Christian Peacemaker teams? Tell us about that.
Well, I'd been on the steering committee for several years, and Gene Stoltzfus was the director of Christian Peacemaker Team, CPT, at that point, said, Cliff, we think you should go on this next team. We've been asked to place a team in Gaza Strip. Well, lots of reasons we could find not to go, that here I was a father with two young teenage daughters, and we were also, it was the summertime, right middle of our busiest time in the garden. How could I leave Arlene and Aaron and Miriam to do all that work while I was gone for 3 months? But I guess it was Miriam that finally said, Daddy, lots of fathers and sons leave home in Gaza and never come home, and you're going to only be gone for 3 months. Maybe we should make it possible for you to go. So, of course, Daddy went. And I remember Rabbi Jeremy Milgram meeting us in Jerusalem. He worked with rabbis for human rights. He said, as you cross the border into Gaza, you cross the border into hell. And it was hell. I've never cried so deeply in my soul as I cried after those 3 months. It was, unemployment was like 80%. Curfews daily, sometimes for a week or two on end. Anybody out could be shot. Giardia in the public water system. No garbage pickup. No sewage system. UN said it was the most densely populated area in the world. It was mostly single story. Tightly packed people. With Israeli soldiers always on the streets, always on the rooftops. 5 times that summer, I was in homes that were raided by Israeli soldiers. Not the same for me as for Palestinians. 90% of the males over 15 years of age had been in prison. Not because they're bad, but it's part of the pressure cooker that Israel is using in Gaza to turn it into a place to transform, to change, to destroy Palestinian society. Schools, kindergartens, or university had been shut down for 2 years. It was brutal. I had some amazing experience. One I remember, I met a young man, probably in his 20s. He'd been arrested 18 times, tortured, same number. He talked about cigarettes being put out in his eyeballs, saws being taken to cut the webbing between each of his fingers, sleep deprivation, cold, heat, noise. But never in my life have I seen someone with the kind of joy that he carried in his spirit. I mean, it boggled my mind. Why isn't he angry? Why isn't he bitter? Why doesn't he go insane? He said, Cliff, they did that to me because they wanted me to respond to them like they were acting toward me. I will never fall to that level. They will never win. What? I mean, I left Gaza angry. But it was returning again and again to Palestine, to Gaza or the West Bank, that taught me patience, a recognition that anger, frustration, we only continue the cycle. But if we can stand in opposition to that anger and violence, perhaps a new future can be shaped. Now, I haven't been specific about some of those events in Gaza, but that's one of my powerful learning experiences during that 3 month stay.
And in the book, you talk about how the trauma that Jews experienced as a culture has a lot to do with the way Israeli society is treating the Palestinians.
Yes, I mean, I took many delegations to Israel-Palestine. One of the places we tried to go was the Holocaust Museum, because I think that's key to understanding what's going on. What mostly Christians in Europe did to Jews is horrendous. What makes it right? Does anything make it right? But if something doesn't transform us, then what happened to us begins to be poured out on somebody else. I think of veterans who've been through terrible, traumatic situations, but don't have a way to heal, to work through those wounds of spirit. And sometimes they take it out on themselves. Look at suicide rates with veterans who've come back from the conflicts. Or look at the mass shootings because they don't have a listening ear, because nobody should be put in the situations they were put in. And for Israelis, the same thing. Nobody should be put in those situations. So how do people heal? How does a people heal so they don't turn that anger and frustration onto another people?
My guest is Cliff Kindy. We're talking about resurrection, peacemaking, plowshare, and the tools of war, his new book. You're not very popular in Israel, are you, Cliff? You talk about it in the book.
Well, I've been in and out of Israel numerous times. About 1998, I'd been arrested several times. Once for opening the gates of the university in Hebron. I had been asked by the students, by the faculty administration, to help open access. It was running, but the gates were concrete blocked shut and welded shut. Vehicle gates were welded shut. And so we said, well, I guess that's something we can do if that's helpful. And so we opened the gates with sledgehammer and chisel, cold chisel. And three of us were arrested along with an Israeli peace activist. But I was still allowed to come in after I went home that time, and nothing seemed to change. But then one time I went back, and I wasn't allowed in. Well, why? Oh, we can't tell you. Well, that's strange. What do you mean you can't tell me? But that continues. I never know. Nobody ever tells me. Israeli security never tells me why I can't go into the country. Uh-huh. After 10 or 15 years, I tried to go back again, because usually after 6 years, you can get back in again. I still can't get in.
Uh-huh. Persona non grata, Cliff Kindy. Cliff, war for you is not some nebulous thing that you describe from a vantage point far away. You have been right there, right inside it. Let's talk about your experiences when the invasion of Iraq was happening. You were there.
Yeah. We went in. Kathy Kelly from Voices in the Wilderness, friend, and I went in with Kathy and two journalists in October of 2002. I had been scheduled to go to Afghanistan because the war had already started there. But it hadn't started in Iraq. And we said, what would it take to stop a war for a change? Could you stop a war? I mean, what would it take? Yeah. I mean, what if you had 500 grandpas and grandmas from the United States on the ground in Iraq before the bombers flew? Would that stop the war? A person I met while I was speaking in Georgia one time, he was flying a fighter jet during Reagan's administration, and he was flying a fighter jet over Libya with heavy bombers flying way up above him. He was down there to try to provoke an incident so that it would provide an excuse for the bombers to level Gaddafi and whatever they wanted to level in Libya. And one day, he sort of came to his senses and said, what am I doing? I mean, if a war starts, I'm dead. And what am I starting a war for? He said, I'm out of here. Turned his jet around, landed, and left. I said, well, why can't that happen other places? I mean, imagine a U.S. fighter getting ready to drop his load on Ramadi or wherever. And I said, all of a sudden he says, wait a minute, grandma's down there. No way, I'm out of here. You know, if there are 500 grandpas and grandmas on the ground, what would it take? Well, we didn't get 500. But we did have, in February before the bombing started, we got a call from Dick Cheney's daughter. Dick Cheney was the vice president of the United States. And she said, I'd like to join you in Baghdad. Well, okay. But before she could get there, Dick Cheney had flown an overnight jet to Amman, Jordan, and talked her out of it. But what if she had been in Baghdad? Well, she's not a really important person. I don't think it was Liz. I don't know who it was, but daughter of Cheney. Then the last delegation from CPT that came in was with Jim Douglas. He had contacts with the cardinals at the Vatican. And they stopped in Rome to see if the Pope would come in with their delegation. What if the Pope had been in Baghdad before the bombers flew? Would that have stopped the war? I mean, start to speculate. What does it take to stop a war? It wasn't like there wasn't huge outcry from around the world, from NATO forces, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, from most of the populations of our allies, hundreds of millions of people saying, no war. But it happened. One story I'll tell from that. 10 days into the bombing. So we were one of the few internationals in Baghdad. We probably had maybe 50 people in our group there in Baghdad. We were in two different hotels, sort of to up the possibility that some of us might live through it. And 10 days in, an airstrike took out the communication center just a couple blocks from where we were staying. So we couldn't call a taxi to go to our meeting that morning, so we walked over. And on the way, we could see the site, and there was a police officer there in the corner. Okay, if we go and check out this communication center that was bombed. And he said, sure, welcome. But there were other people in Baghdad at that time that weren't quite so excited about people that looked like could be undercover from the United States. We probably looked like people from the United States. Mm-hmm. And so we were picked up and ordered out of the country. And on that journey out of the country, it was 300 miles west of the Jordanian border, but it's through the area that the conflict was hot at that time. So there were U.S. fighter jets in the air, burned-out chassis of trucks and buses along the side of this big highway, bomb craters, bridges that had been hit by missiles. And as we were in Rutba, we were passing a chassis of a burned-out bus on the right-hand lane. We were in the left lane. My guess is we picked up some shrapnel at that point. And about 4 kilometers down the road, bang, our left rear tire blew, and we were in the ditch, which would have been fine, except at the end of the ditch there was this concrete abutment, which stopped us. The other two cars in the caravan went on, didn't look back for another half an hour, and they were at the Jordanian border, but we were there by ourselves. All of us injured in the accident, but all still living. We clambered out of the vehicle, and an eastbound Iraqi hollered across the median, "Can I help you?" He loaded us into his vehicle, took us back into Rutba, the only population center in the western desert. And there, medical personnel, first aid people, put us up on tables. This was after 12 years of sanctions, so the medical system was pretty much in shambles, no painkillers and anything like that. And I was the last one. I think they were doing triage, trying to save the easiest ones first. I clamped my hat to my head to staunch the flow of blood. I had a cut in the shape in the top of my head, kind of like the shape of a dome light, because we didn't have seat belts. And I was still awake, and they had explained that it didn't matter whether we were Iraqi or American, they'd take care of us. Didn't matter whether we were Muslim or Christian, they'd take care of us. And as the doctor was sewing up my head, he said, "You know, 3 days ago, a U.S. pilot bombed and destroyed my children's hospital here in Rutba." And I realized at that point that I was the enemy. I was from the same country as the fighter jet that has taken out his hospital. And I'm alive today because my enemy was willing to sew me back up. Sort of a Good Samaritan story. Hmm. But it's... And that's what... That's the kind of hospitality that we found in Iraq. Later on, as house raids and things went on, more and more resistance built up against the United States, and they were starting to say, well, what we had under Saddam was much better than what we have under Bush. And at that point, anybody that looked like us was beginning to be targeted. Anybody who worked with us began to be targeted. But that story, I mean, the Good Samaritan story, and I wasn't the Good Samaritan.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of many accounts in Cliff's new book. It's called Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War, 30 Years with Christian Peacemaker Teams. And the Book Nook will continue with my guest, Clifford Kindy, right after this. You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and my guest on the program today is Clifford Kindy. He joins us on the telephone in Indiana. His new book is Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War. Cliff, you talk about an encounter that you had with a suicide bomber. And I'm going to leave that to readers to read about, because that had the hair on the back of my neck standing straight up.
Well, mine too, to experience it.
I mean, I'm going to leave that for people to read the book, because that's just unbelievable and just so incredible. And let's talk about some of these other places that you've been.
Sure.
You have a really interesting chapter in here about Puerto Rico. I was not aware of this situation down there with this bombing range.
Nor was I. Yeah. It's a place that did a lot of the training for the people that were going to Vietnam and then later on who were going to Iraq. They say that the Vieques is this island off the east end of Puerto Rico. And it's a long island. The east end is a bombing training zone. People live in the middle, and the west end was filled with bunkers, filled with ammunition. The Fishers had been the first ones to start saying things have to change. You know, we used to fish and get lots of fish, but fish aren't alive. They aren't there anymore. We think they're getting poisoned, because that east end was probably the most heavily bombed area in the world, and munitions manufacturers tested their weapons there. It was a place where the Trident submarines could go into the deep waters off the shore of Puerto Rico and fire onto Puerto Rico. The battleships could blast away, the landing ships, the fighter jets, the bombers had clear airspace to the east, and so it was a perfect place. We joined what was already happening there, a resistance against the U.S. Navy on Vieques and that bombing zone. The Secretary of the Navy said, we'll never leave Vieques. There's no place like it in the world. We need Vieques as a training place, a bombing place. But people on the island were starting, birth defects were increasing, cancers and leukemias. And then one day, one of the local guards, David Sanez, was killed by a fighter jet that dropped 120 rounds of depleted uranium weapons accidentally. And things just exploded. I went there when there was like a huge march in San Juan against the Navy presence. Probably 200,000 people. Everybody dressed in white, silent. Mm-hmm. This is powerful stuff. One of the pastors that had gone with me to on a delegation to Palestine, Israel, said, Cliff, CPT needs to be here. So the office said, well, Cliff, check it out. So I went out to the bombing zone. And here there were I mean, there were student groups, there were fisher groups, there were political parties, the Catholics were there, the Protestants were there. They hardly ever agree on anything, but here they were both there. There were veterans groups. I remember there was this one guy who would, part of the bombing zone was mined, and he was skilled. I think he'd been in Vietnam. And so every day he would uncover some of the mines and flag them, and at night the Navy would come in and take them out. They had taken over, there were troop carriers that are abandoned in the zone from landing expeditions. Some of them wouldn't run, some were out of gas, so we had mechanics in this group, and they fixed them up so they'd run, they'd get gas from this one left over in the tanks. We had like a taxi ferry service that went over to the eastern end of the island to connect all the different encampments, the resistance encampments. And every time people set up in the bombing zone, set up tents and stuff, then the Navy would stop bombing. But then they would come and arrest everybody. And I was there, I guess, a couple times when a bunch of us got arrested. But the arrests seemed to be a recruiting tool because more and more people kept coming to be part of the resistance to the Navy presence on VAKs. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a fantastic learning experience. I mean, we took eight or nine different delegations from CPT, but we weren't a main cog in the action. It was happening locally. It was organized locally, and the big numbers of people were from Puerto Rico and VAKs. But to watch what was happening, I mean, one time when they came, there were 2,000 Marines off the coast. There were federal marshals in the air. There were people coming in on land. It was 300 of us out there in the camps, in the tents, in the bombing zone. So it was like a training exercise for the military. Mm-hmm. And we were all arrested, charged with trespass, and taken into jail. They didn't want to have a jury trial. They for sure didn't want that because they knew anybody who went before a jury would be acquitted. So they usually charged us in front of a Navy judge and then put us in a federal prison south side of San Juan. And, you know, but the power, I mean, the most powerful military force the world has ever seen. That's what we were up against. Mm-hmm. And this was this nonviolent action. And they could pull in any number of troops, tools of war that they wanted. And yet, 3 years later, the U.S. Navy pulls off the VA case, closes down Roosevelt Road, the largest Navy station outside the continental United States. They leave. It's like, whoa, what kind of tools did we hold in our hands? I mean, it wasn't like we blasted away with tanks and our own fighter jet. No. It was just persistence. It was creativity. I mean, we used yarn to tie shut the front gate. The resistance communities out there in the bombing zone started to put up solar collectors, started to put up little wind turbines to make electricity out there. It was called the rescue and development of VAKs, to rescue it from a bombing zone to turn it back into a place where people could live. There was teaching going on. There were young students. There were teachers. There were, you know, people from all different occupations. They were part of that resistance. And it was like they were building the new future they wanted for that island. And I think, one of the tools of nonviolence is retaking the initiative from the actors of violence, the people with guns. And I think they were doing that there in the bombing zone, saying, nope, not going to be a bombing zone anymore. Not going to be a bombing zone. Whoa. No, we're never going to leave the VAKs.
That was plowsharing.
That's plowsharing.
That's plowsharing. I want to talk a little bit about Chapter 14.
Okay.
Your title is War by Corporation Globalized. What are your comments about that?
Well, that's what we're in the midst of right now and what I hinted at when you started out. I mean, war isn't good for anybody, whether it's the people who initiate the war or the people who are on the end of the gun in the war zone. It isn't good for a population that spends billions of dollars on war because it means it won't come to build infrastructure in their own country. It won't build schools in their own country. It won't build a health system. It won't build houses in their own country. So, but who does benefit? Well, corporations. I mean, we're selling weapons to Saudi Arabia to destroy Yemen. We're selling, you know, the weapons lobbyists, weapons manufacturers with their lobbying groups in Washington, D.C., make sure that that's the biggest budget item. And we spend half our discretional budget on war. I mean, if you had any country like a South American country or a African country that did that, we'd call it a war state. I mean, how can you do that? Call yourself a good citizen of the world. You know, what's going on? So corporations, and they're globalized. Everybody makes money on war, except soldiers, except the victims, 70% who will be women and children, collateral damage. War. My sense is that war has lost its purpose. There is no purpose for war. It's obsolete. It's discredited. I mean, if war worked, we would have won in Vietnam. If war worked, we would have won in Afghanistan or Iraq. We didn't.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Clifford Kindy, and we're talking about resurrection peacemaking, plowsharing the tools of war, 30 years with Christian Peacemaker Teams. He joins us on the phone in Indiana. Cliff, I know you've got some connections with Dayton, Ohio. I heard a rumor that you were in town. You mentioned early in the interview that you've helped out when there have been natural disasters, and I heard a rumor that you were helping some people in the Dayton area after our terrible tornadoes damaged their homes. And I also saw in your book where you made an appearance on the Phil Donahue Show many years ago, and I'm guessing that was when it was still being produced in Dayton. What were you doing on the Phil Donahue Show?
Arlene and I work with Brethren Disaster Ministries, so I had mentioned we'd go to lots of different disaster zones, and Arlene Cooks and I helped to lead rebuilding crews. And so we were there for a couple weeks after the garden. I guess we left the market a little early this fall just so we could go. But we were there with teams that were in place already, rebuilding homes that had been destroyed or damaged in those tornadoes. I think there were like 19 that hit the Dayton area that night. And so those are renewing times for us, just to be with families who, I mean, they've waited a year, and the rains keep coming into their house. And they said, wow, it rained, and it didn't leak.
Uh-huh.
We had the new roof on. Mm-hmm. And so to experience that with folks and to be able to work with others from all across the country who come as volunteers, it's harder now with the protocols in place with COVID, but BDM has good protocols, and they've worked well for these 10 months or so that we've had to use them on disaster projects, so that was fun. And then Phil Donahue. I was doing, at that point, it was no longer alternative service. I had returned my draft card to President Nixon, knowing as a Quaker he'd understand about conscientious objection and not wanting to support the structures of war. He didn't. He sent it back, and I had later communication with the attorneys of the Criminal Division of the Justice Department. But Phil Donahue was there, and I think a friend of ours, Bob, and I had gone And a friend said, so Curtis Tarr, who was the director of Selective Service at that time, was there on the show. And our friend raised a question, so what are you going to do with people like Cliff and Bob? And there was some discussion back and forth, and Curtis said, well, we'll get them, something like that. And Bob did end up with a two-year sentence. He served, I think, a year and a half in federal prison in Ashland, Kentucky. I was never prosecuted. This was a period when hundreds of thousands of young men were either going to Canada or Sweden or going underground or refusing military duty inside the military or trying to find some way not to go to Vietnam because they didn't want to be a part of that. And so I was never prosecuted. So, yeah, that's one little event that took place in Dayton, Ohio.
Well, right, as you said, you were never prosecuted. The sun came out here in our area.
Oh,
so thanks, Clifford, for that.
Oh, you're welcome. And, I don't think I had anything to do with it.
I'm just teasing you. My guest has been Clifford Kindy. We've been talking about his new book, Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War, 30 Years with Christian Peacemaker Teams. We're running out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners here in Southwest Ohio?
Well, may I share just a little bit about resurrection and how that,
please,
for me, is the power. We usually think about resurrection as sort of the defeat of death, but I've tried to take it a step further, that all the weapons that Rome had at its disposal were used to execute and make sure that once Jesus was in the grave, he wouldn't get out, that nothing untoward would happen. But resurrection is a different kind of power. I call it a nonviolent power because death no longer has dominion. I mean, that's a scriptural quote. Or that 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about it. Death is swallowed up in victory. Death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? For me, that inutility, that uselessness of the weapons of violence, opens a space for the tools of nonviolence. And I think that resurrection spirit is that kind of spirit that allows us to no longer be controlled by fear. The tools of war start with fear, but resurrection moves us beyond that fear, that the tools of war no longer hold that power. And if we're not afraid, we can begin to retake the initiative from the actors of violence. We can begin to build the future that we want to have in place. We can use our energies for goodness rather than badness. So that's the underlying, that's for me, the resurrection piece of the title.
Okay. Well, Cliff, it's really been a pleasure having you as a guest on the program. Thank you so much for your time.
You are very welcome, and it's been my honor to be with you, Vic.
This has been The Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. My guest has been Clifford Kindy, the book Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War. Have a good day.